Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land, hard-working man and brave. He said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave. He went to the preacher, he went to the sheriff, told them all the same. Sell all of your jewelry and give it to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. When Jesus come to town, the working folks around believed what he did say. The bankers and the preachers, they nailed him on a cross, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Now the working people followed him around, sang and shouted gay. But the cops and soldiers nailed him in the air, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Well, the people held their breath when they heard about his death. Everybody wondered why. It was the landlord and the soldiers that he hired to nail Jesus Christ in the sky. This song was made in New York City of a rich man's and preachers and slaves. If Jesus was to preach like he preached in Galilee, they would lay Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man and a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave.
Hello, and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into the program, we're listening to Energy Innovations with Amory B. Lovins and Edward Lucas, who discuss how bold solutions for the new energy era is akin to reinventing fire.
Changing how we make electricity gets easier if we need less of it. And fortunately, although most of it is wasted in both our countries, the techniques for saving it keep getting better faster than we install them. So the unbought reserves of megawatts, saved watts, keep getting bigger and cheaper. But as we get better at delivering efficiency, as buildings and industry start to get efficient even faster than they grow, America's electricity use, rather than growing 1% a year as forecast, could shrink 1% a year even after we count the extra use for the electric vehicles. And we can do this by reasonably accelerating existing trends. So over the next 40 years, U.S. buildings can triple or quadruple their energy productivity, saving $1.4 trillion net present value with a 33% internal rate of return. The savings are worth four times what they cost. Industry can also accelerate, doubling its energy productivity with a 21% internal rate of return. And to do these things by 2050, we would only need over the next 20 years to ramp up the national average rate of efficiency adoption to levels that some of our states have already achieved, whatever exists as possible. I dare say the potential in India, by the way, is even larger. Now, there's a disruptive innovation we've been developing in our little black swan hatchery that makes this easier. It's called integrative design, and it can often make very large energy savings cost less than small or no savings, turning diminishing returns into expanding returns to efficiency investments. That's how a project we did a couple of years ago, led by Indian architect Alok Deshmukh, now back here, is saving now two-fifths of the energy in the Empire State Building, remanufacturing the 6,500 windows in a temporary window factory on a vacant floor into super windows that insulate four times better and let light through but block heat, combined with better lights and office equipment and so on, cut the maximum cooling load by one-third, then renovating smaller chillers rather than adding bigger chillers saved over $17 million of capital cost. That covered the majority of the total cost of all the improvements and thus reduced the payback time to just 3 years. By the way, a major energy service company had also offered a 3-year payback, but on 7% savings, not 40 plus, 6 times less saving because they used disintegrated design. Some retrofits elsewhere are saving as much as 70%, making some old buildings better than new. That's how fast the state of the art is moving. And I think India has similar, if not greater, potential in both new and existing buildings. For example, there's the 70% or so energy savings with lower capex and much better comfort in the new offices that Infosys is putting up now in Bangalore. Now, here's a small building example, and I know it's not a normal Indian climate. I happen to live at 2,200 meters up in the Rocky Mountains near Aspen, where temperatures used to dip as low as minus 44 Celsius. We joke that we have two seasons, winter and July, because you can get frost any day of the year. But this building, which is my home, helped inspire over 30,000 European passive buildings, which, like ours, have and need no heating system to maintain excellent comfort. And they have roughly normal construction costs. They don't need to look like this either to work like this. They can look like whatever you want. Now, if you come into that atrium under glass that insulates like 14 sheets of glass, that looks like two and costs less than three, there you are in this 85-square-meter jungle, and you can see two of the 5 banana crops that were ripening at the time. We're up to crop 46 right now with no furnace, no combustion, no fossil fuel, and a net exporter of solar electricity. And when I moved in 84, this house was saving about 99% of the normal space and water heating energy, and half the water and 90% of the household electricity, all with a 10-month payback. Today's technologies are a lot better, so we've recently retrofitted them, and we're measuring 300 data streams to see how much better they are. The trouble is that the measuring equipment seems to be using more electricity than the lights and appliances. And the sort of approach works in any climate. We've used it to eliminate air conditioning in hot, dry climates up to at least 46 Celsius. That's not a limit. With lower construction cost and better comfort. A friend used it in Bangkok to save 90% of his air conditioning energy with normal construction cost and better comfort. I dare say probably everybody in India lives somewhere between his climate and my climate. And the key, regardless of which climate you're in, is integrative design that gives multiple benefits from single expenditures. For example, the white arch that you can see going around the top of the picture has 12 functions, but it has only one cost. Integrative design can also increase the $500 billion of conventional energy savings in industry. The chemical giant Dow, for example, has invested $1 billion in efficiency and so far got back $9 billion. But there's more to do. For example, three-fifths of the world's electricity runs motors, and half of that runs pumps and fans, and they could all be improved. And the motor systems that run them can be improved in about 35 ways that together save about half the electricity and pay back in a year. But first, we ought to be capturing bigger, cheaper savings that are normally ignored. They are not in the engineering textbooks. They're not in any official study. For example, pumps, the biggest use of motors, move liquids through pipes. A typical industrial pumping loop, though, in a Shanghai factory was redesigned from a supposedly optimal German design to save at least 86% of the pumping energy, not by getting better pumps or motors, although that's often worthwhile, but just by replacing long, thin, crooked pipes with fat, short, straight pipes. And this also shrinks the pumping equipment and hence its capital cost. So this isn't about new technology, but about rearranging our mental furniture as designers. What does this mean for the electricity that's 3/5 used in motors? What does it mean that when I did the same thing in some piping in my house, we saved 97% of the pumping energy? And pumps are, again, the biggest use of motors. Well, from the coal burnt in the power station through to the end use, there are so many compounding losses in the power and pumping systems that only 1/10 of the original fuel energy comes out the pipe as flow. But we can turn those left-to-right compounding losses round backwards from right to left, and they become compounding savings. And then every unit of flow or friction that we save in the pipe compounds back again to save 10 units of fuel and cost and pollution and global weirding back at the power plant. And again, as you go back upstream, the components get smaller and cheaper. So our team has lately found such snowballing energy savings in many diverse industrial redesigns, about $30 or $40 billion worth, from this Hewlett-Packard data center and Texas Instruments chip fab to Anglo-American and Rio Tinto mines, Shell hydrocarbon facilities, and many others. And typically, our retrofit designs save about 30 to 60% of the energy with a 2 or 3 year payback. And in new facilities, it's a bit better, 40 to 90 odd percent savings with almost always lower capex. Now, in all sectors and uses, electric efficiency has extraordinary development leverage for a country like India. Because when you invest in saving electricity rather than supplying more, you need about 1,000 times less capital and you get it back 10 times faster. So in round numbers, it's about a 10,000-fold decrease in the capital required for the most capital-intensive sector, the power sector, which devours about one-fourth of the world's development capital. So turning that sector from a black hole for capital into a net exporter of capital for other development needs can be our most powerful macroeconomic lever for development. And we can achieve this by three main means: buying negawatts, saved watts, whenever they're cheaper than megawatts, rewarding electricity producers and especially distributors for cutting your bill, not for selling you more energy, and allowing electricity savings to compete in the same auctions that buy electricity supply. And these efficiency opportunities are, of course, especially large in India because most of your ultimate capital stock and infrastructure are not yet built, and it's easier to build things right than to fix them later.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Now, needing less electricity would ease and speed the shift to new sources, especially renewables. China is leading their explosive growth and their plummeting cost, shown here on a logarithmic scale for photovoltaic modules in blue and wind farms in green, and both the costs are continuing to come down. In fact, the solar ones are off the bottom of the chart. Solar and wind power are already marketplace winners. Their unsubsidized prices in today's U.S. market for good new installations are at about 4 cents U.S. per kilowatt hour for wind and about 13 for solar. And again, that I backed out the subsidies that they currently get. And in Germany, unsubsidized solar power is as low as 7 to 9 cents a kilowatt hour because the installed system costs are only half what they are in America. That's because Germany went to scale. They put in 3 gigawatts of solar just in the month of December last year. They're putting in 8 gigawatts a year. So they're wringing out costs all through the value chain. Yet even at our twice German costs, our developers in about 20 states will happily come put solar power on your roof with no down payment and beat your electric bill. So that plus some other unregulated products could add up to a virtual utility that bypasses the electric provider, just as cell phones bypass wireline phone companies. This sort of thing gives electricity executives nightmares and venture capitalists sweet dreams, although the incumbents could, of course, turn the insurgency into a major business opportunity. Now, ever since 2008, half the world's new generating capacity has been renewable. A fifth of the world's electricity is renewable. Most of that's made in developing countries. And this graph shows the amount just of wind in blue, photovoltaics in green, capacity added each year worldwide. Last year, these accounted for two-thirds of Europe's new capacity. So electricity production has become a scalable manufactured product, more like making chips or mobile phones than like building cathedrals. Last December, the world could manufacture 59 gigawatts a year of solar cells. Now it's nearer 80. Last year, renewables, excluding big hydro, mainly these two, invested their trillionth dollar since 2004. This is not a fringe activity. It got last year $225 billion of private capital. It added 84 billion watts. It reached 1.5 times the global installed capacity of nuclear power, whose dwindling annual net additions had actually dropped below zero before the Fukushima disaster. India's and China's wind and solar power similarly have far outpaced the nuclear programs. Globally, orders for both nuclear and coal plants keep fading away because they cost too much and they have too much financial risk to attract investors. And in the U.S., we've had 7 years now of 100+% subsidies offered to new nuclear plants, not one of which has been able to raise a penny of private construction capital because they have no business case. Now, natural gas prices also remain volatile and are going back up, but renewables and efficiency have falling capex and no fuel. So these modern competitors have already, in 6 years, taken away a third of coal's market in the U.S., and they can take the other two-thirds at less than just the operating cost of existing coal plants. We're often told, though, that only coal and nuclear stations can keep the lights on because they are 24/7, while solar and wind are variable and thus supposedly unreliable. But actually, no generator is 24/7. They all break. And when a big plant fails, you lose 1,000 megawatts in milliseconds, often for weeks or months, often without warning. That's why we've always designed the grid to cope with this intermittence by backing up failed plants with working plants. And in exactly the same way, grids can handle the forecastable variations of solar and wind power in diversified portfolios that are forecasted and integrated with the grid. Our government has published scenarios for 80 or 90% renewable electricity in the U.S. with full reliability. And let me just show you a quick example of how this can work in the state of Texas, which has an isolated grid not connected to anything else. The forecast 2050 load shape over a week looks like this. With efficiency, it gets smaller and less peaky. Now let's make it 100% renewable. We'll meet 84% of the annual need with a combination of wind power and photovoltaics, and then the other 14% with other renewables that are dispatchable. You can have them whenever you want. Geothermal, solar thermal electric, municipal waste combustion, small hydro, burning biogas in combustion turbines, and so on. So it's still not a perfect match to the load shape. Sometimes we have too much, sometimes too little. But let's take the surplus and put it into two kinds of distributed storage, ice storage air conditioning and smart charging of electric vehicles. Then we get that back again when we need it. We fill in the last gaps with unobtrusively flexible demand. Now all the moving parts fit together properly, and with no bulk storage, we are meeting all needs reliably every hour of the year with all renewables, and only 5% of the generation is left over, so the economics are good. And some utilities are already doing this sort of thing. Even 2 years ago, four German states were 43 to 52% wind-powered, Portugal 45% renewable, Denmark 36%. Germany is currently 26% renewable, and at times this spring it went to 60%. They've doubled their renewables in 5 years. They plan to nearly double them again by 2025, and such European experience is supporting a transition over decades to largely or wholly renewables for the entire European Union. At the same time, Denmark, for example, has radically decentralized its electric production from big coal plants to a mixture of decentralized combined heat and power, mainly using agricultural waste and wind power, 86% owned by the farmers or their communities. Now, in America, we've got this aging, dirty, insecure power system that we have to replace by 2050. And whatever we replace it with is going to cost about the same. More of what we've got, new nuclear and so-called clean coal, decentralized renewables, centralized renewables. But those futures, all costing about the same, differ profoundly in their risks around national security, fuel, water, finance, technology, climate, health. For example, both our countries have over-centralized grids, vulnerable to cascading and potentially economy-shattering blackouts. Imagine if the lights did not go back on after your events in July. These things can be caused by operational problems, or more seriously, the equipment can actually be destroyed by solar storms. It's just a matter of when, not if. By other natural disasters like the superstorm we just had, by physical attack, by cyber attack. And that blackout risk is very serious, but it disappears, and all the other risks are best managed with distributed renewables reorganized into so-called microgrids that normally interconnect, but stand alone at need. So they disconnect fractally, they reconnect seamlessly. My house does that. It works with or without the grid. The Pentagon is reorganizing its own power supplies this way because they need their stuff to work. Well, so do the rest of us whom they're defending. And this inherently resilient grid architecture, if adopted nationwide at the same cost as business as usual, would maximize national and individual security, customer choice, entrepreneurial opportunity, and innovation. So let me summarize the electricity story. Together, efficient use and diverse, dispersed renewable supplies are starting to transform the whole sector. Traditionally, utilities bought giant plants, maybe a little efficiency of renewables, and we would reward them for selling us more electricity. But now, especially where they're rewarded instead for cutting our bills, They shift massively towards efficiency, renewables, combined heat and power, ways to blend them all together reliably with less transmission and little or no bulk storage. So our energy future is not fate but choice, and that choice is extremely flexible. Around 1975, U.S. government and industry insisted that the amount of energy used to make a down, so it was heretical when I said it could actually go down threefold. How are we doing? Well, it's gone down by half so far. We're pretty much on schedule. And with today's far more powerful technologies, integrative design, more mature finance and delivery channels, we can clearly see another tripling in efficiency ahead at even lower cost. So to solve the energy problem, we just needed to enlarge and integrate it. And the results may at first seem incredible. They even surprised us. But as Marshall McLuhan said, only puny secrets need protection. Big discoveries, he said, are protected by public incredulity. Now combine the electricity and oil revolutions, and we have the big story, reinventing fire, where business, enabled and sped by smart policies in mindful markets, can lead a big economy completely off oil and coal, saving lots of money, growing the economy, in this case 2.6-fold, strengthening security, and by the way, cutting carbon emissions 82 to 86%. And if you like any of those outcomes, any one or more, you can support this transition without needing to like every outcome, without needing to agree which outcomes are most important. So focusing on outcomes, not motives, can turn conflict and gridlock, which I think both of our legislatures have to some degree.
Come here and gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage. From underneath the vestiture of law, the lobbyists at Washington do gnaw. At liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We had little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We will not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the others in the till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the honors in the view till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many. You are the few.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.